Hi guys, so today I'm going to talk about patient assessment. I really would like to start getting into like the different etiologies of like the different conditions that you'll be tested on. But first we need to know what a regular assessment is compromised of and how it's broken down. This is how you're going to know what's normal, what's not normal, etc., etc. So having a understanding of this is crucial before you start learning the things that are abnormal that your class is going to walk you through. So basically, an outline of a new patient assessment for a paramedic consists of a scene management, preliminary assessment, a primary assessment, a secondary assessment, and a treatment and reassessment. Now, depending on where you live, like where I live, the commute from wherever you're at to a hospital is typically like 5 to 10 minutes. So a lot of times the secondary and or even the preliminary assessment don't even happen as thought out as you would think that they would. But in certain cases, it's just looking across the room and being able to tell, okay, this patient's good, this patient's not good. And I'm going to tell you guys that you don't learn in school. You learn on the job. I didn't know anything about that. And I started working pediatrics and I would often be like, what's wrong with him? Like, there's nothing wrong with him. If I was, you know, like to see a baby, and the mom would know because obviously that's his mom. And the nurse would tell me like, yeah, like he's not breathing well, but I wouldn't be able to tell that because I can't see underneath his shirt. Babies breathe differently, but over time working with adults and children, because my first job I did some adults too, I was able to look across the room. And there's a term for that when you get into pediatric, the pediatric part of your paramedic education. But I was able to look across the room without using any tools to measure this patient's oxygen or listen to their lungs or take their pulse. I was able to look across the room and say sick versus not sick. And that is something that you don't learn in school. You learn that on the job. It's something that your gut can tell you, and typically it's correct. And you know what? At the end of the day, if you walk into the ER with your patient on the stretcher and you're like, oh my God, this is happening, and you freak out to the physician and the physician says, oh no, like that's not what it was, but thanks, then whatever. It doesn't matter. You were able to identify that something was not wrong with the patient, and was wrong with the patient, but it's a lot better than not catching something that was wrong and then your patient suffers for it and then you look incompetent. So if you ever have a gut feeling about something, go with it and run with it. It doesn't matter if you look like an idiot afterward because you overreacted, because the time that you don't overreact and you underreact, then you're really going to look like an idiot. So I just wanted to get that out of the way first before we started, because a lot of this you're not going to understand at first how to do it without touching the patient. But in time, I promise you, when you start working, you're going to start to be able to look at a patient and say good versus not good. Some of you may be able to do it already that have a little bit of experience working as an EMT or even employed by a fire department. You can already tell if this is serious or if this is BS, because obviously a lot of calls that we get sometimes are not essentially real emergencies. So, but it's an emergency to the patient. Never forget that. Never minimize what they feel because it's an emergency to them. Just remain professional about it. So at first, scene management, this is when you're not touching the patient. In paramedic school, they make you say BSI, scene safety. That stands for body substance isolation precautions. So BSI, scene safety, your gloves and your goggles or anything else that you might need. Now it's with a mask too, because everybody wears a mask. You assess the scene for threats, hazards. What's the scene look like? Is there PD there? Is PD saying it's not okay to come in yet? Was it a structure fire? Can't go in there. You know, if you're medical, you can't go in unless you're in a department where there's both, like there is a lot down here. All of them are both EMS and fire. Then maybe, yeah, you can go in if you have your SCBA on and everything. Assess the need for additional resources. sometimes a patient's really heavy. Sometimes the patient lives on the sixth floor and there's no elevator. So you're going to need additional resources. Maybe it's a pediatric call. As far as I know, the counties around us, every single time there's a pediatric call and it comes to my ER, because I work in a pediatric trauma center, the battalion chief always comes. So that might not be an additional resource for the team working with the pediatric, but it's an additional representation of the department. And the battalion chief has to be there for something that's so not common when it comes to calls with a department. If there's a number of patients, if there's not just one, you have to request more personnel. There's only a couple of you and there's 10 patients, it's not going to happen. And then, once you ask that, whoever's testing you is going to tell you one patient or whatever. Control the scene. So, you know, this is kind of like not so much like in school, but like, you know, position your EMS unit, provide lighting, remove obstacles, eliminate distractions, clear area around the patient. Now, in the sense of trauma, you always want to verbalize in this first part if you need to consider C-spine precautions. Now, your professor or your teacher, whatever your instructor, will say, you know, sometimes they'll say at this point, you know, no reason for C-spine precaution. But then when you get to the preliminary assessment or when you start assessing your patient, you're like, wait, but this patient fell off a ladder. I have to do C-spine precautions. A lot of teachers will say that no in the beginning because they want to see if you're able to use your brain and think like, oh, hey, like have some critical thinking skills and be like, hey, this person fell off a ladder. Verbalize it and then always ask again what happened, and then if you think that you might need to do C-spine precautions, say it. So now going into like the preliminary assessment, this is the way that I learned it. It might not be the same in this book, but this is good to know because these parts are really important. And they're good to verbalize. Typically, if you verbalize more than what's required of you, the chances of you passing your lab testing is higher than not. So if you just sound like a big explosion of information, you just know all this stuff, sometimes your teacher might just stop you in the middle of your lab testing and it'll be like, okay, good, you passed. So knowing more than what you're expected to know is always good. So in your preliminary assessment, you're observing, but it's prior to like any major contact. So you assess for control and severe hemorrhage. You know, you do a quick visual scan on the patient. Does this patient have all of his limbs? Is his shirt ripped and he's bleeding everywhere? Does he have a gunshot wound? Like things like that. Assess for a mechanism of injury. That goes with your scene. What happened? Did they get into a car crash? Are they crashed into something? Are they inside of a car? Are they on the side of the road? Is there a big ladder with Christmas lights next to them and they are on the floor? Assess the nature of illness. So this is more for like a medical call. Are they inside of their house on their sofa in tripod position? Are they clutching their heart saying, oh my God, there's an elephant sitting on top of my chest. It feels so horrible. Are they just laying down and they're just so lifeless and you don't even know if they're responsive? Those are the things that you have to think about. And it's very difficult when you're in lab testing because you have this mannequin that's like super white. It has no color to it and it's dirty. And when you have to make up your own story in your head, almost like you have to visualize the patient while you're lab testing, while you have to remember all of these things to say. So it can be very difficult lab testing. I find lab testing a lot harder than real people because I have to ask all of these things. In real life, I can look at my patient and I can draw a million conclusions just by looking at them. Formulate your general impression. So this goes back to what I was saying. Is this patient sick or not sick? If your patient is in tripod position on the couch using his accessory muscles to breathe, and he doesn't look too good. His face is kind of gray, his lips are kind of blue, and there's an oxygen tank next to him. He's got a nasal cannula on. What are those things telling you? This patient might have COPD. This patient's having difficulty breathing. Something's wrong. Something's not right. This is not how this patient spends their everyday life. That's why they called you, because something's wrong. Your general impression can be also, you know, their behavior. How are they behaving? Are they erratic? Are they throwing things? Are they like a threat to you? Well, you have to protect yourself before you protect other people. Are they a psychiatric patient? Are they, you know, drunk? Are they under the influence of drugs? What does their skin look like? Is it cool? I mean, what is it? Is it super pale? Is it red? Is it gray? Is it blue? Is it purple? Are they super cherry red and they were stuck in their garage for a long time? What do those things tell you? So you kind of have to draw those conclusions. It'll be easier to draw those conclusions and pick up on those kinds of clues when you kind of know like what you're learning about, which sometimes I wish patient assessment was taught alongside things that were abnormal, just so you can learn the patient assessment for each one. But sometimes they just teach it like sporadically. But I learned patient assessment. I learned a normal patient assessment, and then I knew what normal was. And then when I looked at abnormal, I was like, oh, that's not normal. So that's an easier way to do it. But yeah. So you go into your primary assessment, your level of consciousness. Now you're touching this patient now that, like, to give you kind of like a picture of where you're at. Level of consciousness. You got to ask them, you know, hi, how are you? Like, are you, do you know what day it is? Like, do you know what time it is? Are they oriented to time, place, person? Those types of things. Are they looking at you in the eye? Things like that. Sorry, I was looking through something. Are they responsive? Are they oriented? Like I said, airway and breathing. Do you look at their chest? Do they have equal rise and fall? You know, take their pulse really quick. Can you feel a nice pulse? Is the pulse thready? Is it bounding? Is it weak? Is it really fast? Is it really slow? Is it irregular? Things like that. So your ABCs, these are your things that you always check with a live patient, ABC in that order. Now, as an extra tidbit, whenever you look at a question, you need to look at that question. And I didn't even know this until nursing school. I would look at a question, I'd be like, oh, it's that one. I wouldn't even use this like systematic like approach. And I might sound like an idiot, because probably you guys know this, and it took me like 4 years and a nursing education to learn this. But when you look at a question and you don't know the answer, like, you might not be like, oh, I don't remember the symptom of this, I don't remember the symptom of that. If you look at the answer and it's a priority based question, and you look at it, the answer choices, as an ABC, whatever is airway is going to be the right answer. Doesn't matter if you don't know what the answer is about. It doesn't matter if you don't know what the hell the question is talking about. If one of the answers is airway, that's the answer, because it's always A, B, C. That's always what is important first in a conscious patient, A, B, and C. So I just wanted to like specify that really quick for you guys. So some ways that you can kind of like check this part, you know, if they're like, you know, airway, breathing, circulation, you could do it pretty quickly. You could, you know, sit in front of them, take, you know, put your hand, put your two fingers on their radial pulse, and just like, you know, just watch them. You know, just look at them, you know, like, reassure them and look at their chest rise and fall. Don't ever tell a patient that you're counting their respirations, because they're going to be exaggerating their respirations. So after that, you determine your chief complaint. Now, if you've been to EMT school, you know exactly how you determine that. You ask a sample. You ask a sample. S stands for signs and symptoms. You want to know their allergies. You want to know their medications. You want to know their past medical history that they'll tell you, because they'll tell you, oh yeah, I'm on lisinopril and I'm on metoprolol, but they have no cardiac history. So they obviously have high blood pressure if they're on lisinopril, but they're not going to say that because the ACE inhibitor is controlling their blood pressure. The last time that they ate, after that patient is in your presence, they're not eating anymore. That's it. Last oral intake, that was it. They're not going to drink or eat anything, because when they get to the ER, that physician's not going to let them drink or eat anything either. And then what they were doing before all of this happened. Now, if their chief complaint has to do with pain, you want to ask them, you know, when did this pain start? Does it go anywhere? What's the quality? What makes it better or worse? How severe it is, and the time that it started. Along with that too, I would always just throw this in when I was lab tested. I would ask them, did you take any medication for this pain? Because if you don't ask, your teacher's not going to tell you. Because patients typically don't tell you things unless you ask them. I will go over DCAP-BTLS, but this is more for trauma. And DCAP-BTLS stands for deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, burns, tenderness, lacerations, and swelling. I want to do a patient assessment podcast on trauma only. So I'm going to go ahead and save that for a whole other podcast, because that one's a lot more extensive and I like it a lot more. So I have a feeling it's going to be longer. And then this is when you're going to take your baseline vital signs in the primary assessment. So the kind of vital signs that you're looking for depend on what the chief complaint is. And I'm going to tell you what I mean. If your patient, you could say you could do these in the ABC order all the time, right? But if your patient is complaining of trouble breathing, are you going to check their temperature first? No, that doesn't matter right now. The priority is their breathing. So you're going to auscultate their lungs and you're going to get a rate of their breathing. Is it labored or is it unlabored? Then you're going to get their pulse. The same thing. If somebody had chest pain, you want to get a heart rate and a blood pressure first. So you're going to get their pulse. You're going to describe it. Is it weak? Is it thready? Is it bounding? Is it strong? Is it fast? Is it slow? Is it irregular? Is it irregular? Is it irregular or regular? You want to look at their skin. Is it cool and clammy, or is it hot and red? You want to look at their pupils. Are they normal reactive to light, or are they fixed? That's not good. do they react? Are they super dilated? Is there a reason to believe this patient is under the influence of any medication or drugs? You want to get their blood pressure. Is it elevated? Are they hypertensive or are they hypotensive? Are they normotensive? And you want to get a pulse oximetry. Every literature is different, but anything between 95 and 100 is normal. So if it's 97, 96, don't freak out. But if it's less than 95, you might, you know, kind of like warm up their hands a little bit and put it on again. Sometimes when the patient's cold, I've taken my pulse oximetry while my hands are cold and it's like 89. So, and sometimes if the patient has like gel nail polish or something like that, it might block the sensor that's trying to read the pulse oximetry. So going on to the next part, that's a preliminary assessment. That's a primary assessment. Now your secondary assessment. So now your primary assessment, let's go back. Your primary assessment, you have to look at their level of consciousness, their responsiveness, their orientation, their airway and breathing and circulation, their pulse, their skin color, their temperature, its moisture. Determine their chief complaint. Determine their status. Are they stable or are they unstable? That is the biggest question out of the primary assessment. Do I need to press this gas on this truck, or do I need to stay and play a little bit? So, you know, you have to make that kind of like decision. Do I need to make some interventions here on the scene, or do I need to make some interventions on the way, or do I need to just get to the hospital like now? So your secondary assessment now. This part you still do. A lot of people do this, depending on what the situation is. So, for example, secondary assessment, if the patient's complaint is chest pain, you're always going to do a 12 lead. Now, typically, from what I've remember and from what I've seen, the 12 lead is always done in the patient's home. They don't want to move the patient from where they're at, because now you're talking about a safety issue. You want to be able to get a quick 12 lead and see what you're dealing with. Now, the result of that 12 lead is what's going to determine, is this patient stable or unstable? So sometimes your patient might have okay pulse, maybe a little tacky, okay skin color, temperature's fine, their moisture's fine, they're alert and oriented, but they're having an MI. It's common and it happens. So in this secondary assessment, sometimes part of it will be in the home or wherever they're at, and you get a 12 lead, and the 12 lead comes out, okay, they have an inferior MI, okay, that's not good, so let's go. So that'll prompt you to be like, okay, we need to leave, and maybe do some interventions on the way to the hospital, not at the house. So another good example of that is a stroke. So, you know, you come, let's say the patient's daughter is complaining, oh, I just came home. I was here a couple of hours ago and my mom was fine. And then I came home from doing errands and now she can't move her left side. Okay, so that was 3 hours ago, the last time that she saw her normal. So as you will learn in paramedic school, time, the brain is time. Time is brain. So like you need to get that patient to the hospital now, like as soon as possible. So that paramedic is not going to stay in play. They're going to pack the patient up and drive because they need to get there as soon as possible. So in the secondary assessment, you'll remove necklaces, chains, whatever, loose jewelry. Typically, yeah, sometimes, depends. If it's a trauma, they're going to the hospital in their birthday suit. That'll definitely happen. Sometimes you'll delegate if you have some EMTs around you. Where I live, they're typically all three of them are paramedics. So there's not a lot of delegation going on. Everybody does their role. Everybody does, what they need to do. You have to see what position is going to be best for the patient. Oxygen therapy, EKG, vital signs, again, another SpO2, a blood glucose if it's like a diabetic patient or has a history of diabetes. And sometimes the patient's family will just be like, here's an entire bag of my entire medications. And you'll have to be able to look through them and see what. There's lots of things that you can utilize to do that. There's a lot of apps on your phone that you could use. Like Hippocrates, I have a U-bound one that I use, and I just look up a medication. It was free with my nursing school. Looking up your medication on your phone doesn't look great when you're in front of a patient. So I wouldn't do that. I mean, honestly, like you can't remember every single medication in the world, but you can kind of like start to put them together once you see the endings of them over and over again. Like anything that ends with statin, like that's usually a cholesterol medication. Anything that ends in LOL, that's a beta blocker. Anything that ends in Pril, that's typically an ACE inhibitor. So like those are things that you start to like learn when you look at medications. So you want to interview the patient. Depending on the situation, it could be a fast interview or a long interview, but usually it's fast. But ask them their history of present illness, their social, family, lifestyle history, general medical history, allergies, medications. This goes back to your sample and your primary assessment. So usually if you get kind of like those things out of the way at first, you know, you kind of like facilitate a more efficient way of like assessing this patient. Now, treatment and reassessment. Now, if you live somewhere where the hospital is like super far away from where you're going, like you live out in the boondocks or something, then yeah, you're going to have to reassess. But typically, you're there within 15 minutes. Faster if you drive faster. So if it's something that you can treat on there, or start to treat, because you're not going to completely cure the problem on the ambulance, you're going to have to take them to the ER, where the doctors and the nurses are going to cure the patient or help the patient with whatever they're experiencing. But you can start that process. So if the patient's asthmatic and they're having an asthma attack, you're going to start that albuterol, you're going to start an IV, you're going to start all those things that the nurses and the doctors need from the paramedics to go ahead and continue the work that you've laid out, that you've started. So, then you're going to treat it as much as you can, but I mean, you're not going to waste as much time. I want to clarify that a little bit, because I just realized what I just said. You're going to begin to treat them. That's what I should say. You're going to begin to treat them, and then you're going to hand it off. If you did something that's like, if you do anything to the patient, so that means if you give medication, if you hung a bag of saline, if you do anything, you want a reassessment before you get them out. If time allows. But this is a really quick reassessment. This is not a okay, how's your, let's do this all over again, head to toe assessment. No. This is just a level of consciousness. Hey, sternal row, are you good? Literally just like that. That's an example. Are you okay? How are you feeling? How's your pain? And you're going to have them connected to a life pack. So you're going to have their vital signs. They're going to have, you'll see a simple EKG. You'll see a simple lead 4 ECG strip. You'll see their pulse ox. If you have them on a nasal cannula with capnography, you'll see their CO2. You'll see their pulse ox. You'll see their pulse ox. And then you can set that life pack to do a blood pressure every 5 minutes. Perfect. There you go. So that's your reassessment. But if you gave an intervention, if you did an intervention, you're going to want a reassessment of that, of whatever you did. So for example, this is just an example. You gave nitroglycerin to somebody who had chest pain. So you want to reassess that pain before you drop them off at the hospital. So a quick reassessment, just to make sure that they didn't deteriorate right when you're getting into the hospital. That's important, because that expresses competency, that you know what you're doing. You don't want to drop this patient off at the hospital and be like, well, I don't know, I did this, but I didn't ask him how he felt after. You don't want to do that, because that just makes you look bad. And that's not what a competent paramedic does. You want to be not the standard, but above the standard of what a paramedic is. This is not a joke, this profession. This is real, and you can hurt people if you don't do something correctly. So basically, like I've said in the first video, and I'll say it again, paramedic school is not going to teach you how to become a paramedic. They're just making sure that you're a competent, safe paramedic when they give you that license, because you need to be safe and competent to take care of people. So now that I did my spiel at the end, that's pretty much it. That's patient assessment, a normal patient assessment. I added my email in my little welcome message when you log into my dashboard. When you see my dashboard, I don't know how it looks like on your app or on your phone or whatever, but that's my email. And I would love some feedback, anything that would make this better. If you have any questions about anything, I'd be more than happy to answer them. And if you had any requests for any type of specific podcast, I would love to do it. So if you can find that email, go ahead and shoot me one. Thanks so much for listening.